Good afternoon, everyone. Good evening. When does afternoon turn to evening? Okay. Anyway, it's nice to have you here for this university colloquium. I'm very happy to introduce Professor Steve Johnson. Many of you know him and have already appreciated his work in various venues. Steve received his MFA in it was a long title, design and a bunch of stuff from the Savannah School of Savannah. I reviewed this on my way down. Savannah College of Art and Design, is that right? Yes. In 2001, and joined EMU's faculty in 2005, and is currently serving as chair of the Visual and Communication Arts Department. Like I said, many of us have had opportunity to enjoy his work in the past. I need to tell at least one story of my own. Last summer, I was putting together a presidential address for the Association for the Sociology of Religion in New York in August, and I wanted to have some nice visuals on my PowerPoint, and the theme of the address was rivers. So I said, Steve, do you got any images? And he sent me a bunch of links and said I was free to use them. And actually made a really effective background for the points I was trying to make in the talk, and I was very proud to have that kind of a venue to brag on my faculty. I was a little bit disconcerted afterwards when I got almost as many compliments on the pictures as I got on the content of my talk, but anyway, that tells you you're in for a treat. He's going to be reporting today on his sabbatical last year in Oregon, at the Oregon Extension, where he did a lot more photographing, not just of rivers, but of the creatures in the rivers and in the woods. And I know I'm looking forward to hearing more about his work. Welcome.
Thank you. Marty, before you turn down the lights, I just wanted to introduce Heidi Gaiman from the Oregon Extension. It turned out when we rescheduled this talk that Heidi was going to be recruiting for the Oregon Extension program at the same time. So that was really fortuitous and real glad to see her from my semester out west. Okay. So this sabbatical came out of two ideas that I had. Make sure this is going here. Go. I applied to the committee, and I want to give thanks to the committee for making this sabbatical possible, with the idea that two possible things might work out. I might be able to go and teach at the Oregon Extension program for a semester, and I might be able to go and do some work documenting biodiversity in what's called the Cascade-Siskiyou National Monument. And maybe I'd be able to do both of those things if the funding worked out. And I talked to some of the folks out at the Oregon Extension program, and I'll say more about that program in a minute, and they came up with a sabbatical position that Anna Marie and I split. So we were very grateful to be able to make a full year of this. It was a really great experience. Also, two of our students were out there, Heidi Long and Brandon Waggy, and they'll make some guest appearances in this presentation. So after the sabbatical was approved, we did a lot of planning, and in July of 2012, we packed up our car and put as many possessions in it as we could, shipped a few boxes, but not that many. We really scaled down, and we brought our two kids and our crazy dog. I think you can tell the little bit of the devil in her eyes there. That's her peeking up between my legs. That's how I had to hold her the entire trip. So she didn't jump into Anna Maria's lap while she was driving. And our cat. Our cat was there, too. So that was an adventure in and of itself. This was the route that we took across the country, stopping in the motherland for many of you, Iowa. Anna Maria's family is from there, and finally ending up in southern Oregon. And this is where the Oregon Extension is actually located, very close to the California border. And you can see it right there, 1561 Oregon 66, Highway 66 was our address. So the first part of the sabbatical involved teaching at the Oregon Extension semester program. Now, I know a lot of you as faculty and some of you as students are familiar with this program, but some of you may not be, and you may only be passingly familiar with it. So I thought I'd put a few slides together that get at the basic idea. I also, while I was out there, did a revised video for the OE. This was something I had put together a number of years ago, and we updated it with new faculty and new students. So I think I'll show a few minutes of that, too, to get a flavor for the program. But first of all, I think this is what some of our current students face. At least I see this in the classroom. And don't forget where to sit in the cafeteria. So I find that oftentimes students in my classes feel overwhelmed by all of the competing interests. And really, one of the prime ideas behind the Oregon Extension program is to bring students out for a semester on top of a mountain where there are very limited distractions and where you're studying one thing at a time with a small group of fellow learners. So what if you took all those things away? And that too. And just to be fair, there are a couple things that replace those items. Students have to do their own grocery shopping, do their own cooking, and chopping wood. And that's our very own Brandon Waggy. Pretty good at it. I think he picked it up pretty quick. So the tagline for the Oregon Extension is a fall semester out of the mainstream. And this video, I'll show you a few minutes of it, should give you a pretty good sense of what it's about.
The discussions that we have formally and the discussions that happen over dinner or walking in the woods, I think those sorts of discussions are the ones where I find more and more that my academic life and the rest of my life aren't separate things. They're one thing.
So it's really exciting to be able to work on projects with students that they are very passionate about and to be able to share what I'm passionate about and for all of us to be able to talk about what we really think.
We were a group of friends who did a lot of paddling of canoes around the Boundary Waters canoe area with college students and discovered that if you get a group of students together outside the classroom or in a little bit more of a continuous living situation, get to know them, you begin to hear their real questions. We came up with this idea to have a college program. We were all from the Midwest or the East and we thought, well, let's try the West. We found this property here in Southern Oregon. We came along just in time to grab it up as a whole, keep it together, borrowed money from all of our friends and family, and a little bit from the school, and bought the place and came out here the summer of 75 with hammers and saws and gradually renovated this place to the point where it could actually support human habitation.
This area, referred to as the Klamath-Siskiyou ecoregion, has probably the most complex, or one of the most complex terrains geologically on the face of the Earth. It also, and partly because of the geology, is one of the two or three most important biodiversity hotspots in the United States. Within about a three-hour drive of Lincoln, students will encounter high desert. Students can find glaciers on Mount Shasta. Students can find the Oregon Caves, the Pacific Coast, Redwood Forest, some of the richest temperate Doug fir forest in the world, as well as the deepest lake in the United States, Crater Lake. And so these questions, and seeing sort of a diversity of ideas, they see perhaps how that relates to different natural landscapes.
What's different here is we study in blocks, and that means each course is studied by itself for 3.5 weeks with nothing competing with it, no other courses. The first segment's on the natural world, second segment is on the social world, third segment is on the human person, and the fourth segment is on the religious world. During what we call the core phase of a segment, which is the first week and a half of each segment, a typical day would be students show up with faculty at 9 o'clock in the morning in the library for a lecture that will have some relationship to the previous day's reading. mid-morning, we'll take a break, then we'll go out into small discussion groups, students and faculty, discuss the previous day's reading, and at 12:30 every day, the students have completed their classroom work and have the rest of the day until 9 o'clock the next morning to do the reading for the following day.
And for about 2 weeks at a time, all of us are reading the same books together, all the faculty and all the students. After lecture every day at about 11:30, we have small discussion groups. One faculty member and 4 to 6 students meet in a faculty person's home, and they talk about the reading from that night, and they also talk about any ideas, questions, things that spring up in their mind related to that reading or the conversation or the lecture. Those conversations can be free-ranging, or sometimes they're pretty focused, but either way, I think they help foster that sense that what we're trying to do is have a conversation about ideas and about what matters, not just figure out what the book was about and see if we can master that.
Small groups are one of my favorite parts of being at the OE. We do a significant amount of reading of really meaningful books. And during small groups, we get a chance to discuss everything we've read. We come together in the professors' houses and share coffee and tea. And it's just a beautiful thing because I'm reading the book and I'm thinking one thing, whereas someone brings something else just totally different and unique to the table.
The best small groups are the ones where we end up going somewhere where we didn't expect to go at the beginning. We might start talking about some of the ideas in the book or some of the characters in the books we've been reading. But eventually, it collides with our lives, and it collides with other books we've been reading, and things we've heard in lecture, and things we've experienced in our cabins, and just here in the West, on our trips, and spending time on the mountain.
So it goes on to talk about the weekends, the travel schedule. Students have a lot of experience getting out into the West, and I'll show you a few pictures from that, too. But at the core is this idea of students living in community, doing chores together, cooking together, and all the faculty and all the students reading the same books and talking about the ideas that develop over the course of a semester. So it's really a kind of sustained conversation. And it feels like a real gift to be able to spend 2 hours every day talking to students, unpacking ideas that we're developing together as a community. And again, one thing at a time, so there's no competition. We did have a reading list, probably about a dozen books during the course of the semester. This is a sampling of the type of books that appear at the OE. Literature, current events, books about the natural world, etc. One of my particular sabbatical goals was to develop some new lecture material that was focused on the intersection of visual culture, ecology, narrative, and empathy. I was asked right at the beginning of this process to talk a bit about technology and social media and its impact. The Oregon Extension has a very specific philosophy about this, where they severely restrict cell phone use. So students actually take their cell phones and put them in a box at the beginning of the week and get them back on the weekends. And for current students, that might sound crazy, but students who come out of the program say over and over again how much they appreciate this. Because for once, they get to be unplugged and released from the demands of all of these pressures of responding to texts and can be truly present in their current context. There's also a limiting of internet use, although it comes back for some of the research sections of the program. Other lecture material that I worked on, again, a really interdisciplinary approach. I got to talk about science fiction. I got to talk a little bit about a photo series that I had developed called The Creatures Among Us. A perennial favorite is Dostoevsky and the Brothers Karamazov. So I got to get back in contact with my colleague Jerry and talk about icons and pick his brain a little bit. I found this approach really stimulating. For the most part, I think it was really helpful for students to see faculty at these presentations too. So to have 5 faculty members in the room offering their perspectives, getting into discussions with students. Those Q&A sessions allowed both faculty and students to clarify and disagree and expand the points that were made in the lectures. Some of the highlights for me, hearing from other faculty, learning about the historical origins of the notion of hysteria, comparing Muslim and Christian notions of God, exploring Annie Dillard's use of image patterns. That was Anna Maria, who is also teaching in the program, my wife. She had done her thesis work on Annie Dillard and Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. unpacking the notion of scapegoating in a theological context. In addition, we had faculty experts in Muslim studies, ethics, environmental literature, biblical studies. So these readings opened up a whole range of interpretive possibilities beyond what I might encounter in my own discipline. Again, I mentioned picking Jerry's brain about his icon work. The community itself, Lincoln, Oregon, is a converted logging community. And it's been out of commission in the logging industry for quite a number of decades. But as you saw in the video, the initial faculty in the mid-70s took over the property, fixed it up, got a lot of donations, a lot of volunteer labor, and it's this beautiful campus now. Students arrive on campus and get to know each other, probably something familiar to us Mennonites, getting together for a potluck. A few more pictures of what the community looked like. We stayed in a house for part of our time there, and then when the students left in the spring semester, we actually moved into one of the student cabins while they renovated a house for new faculty who were coming in. This is my daughter, Maggie, in the bottom corner. She had a tiny little place to stay, and she loved that. As you saw in the video, too, faculty and students meet in homes over tea and coffee to discuss books. So it's a very welcoming type of atmosphere. Immediately behind the campus, the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument opens up. As you saw from Jamie Skillen, a Calvin faculty member who's now at the OE, this is an incredibly diverse region, geographically and in terms of its biology. One of the most recent buildings is the one you see up here on the top right, a new chapel that's out in the woods. Students had opportunities to be a part of Vespers there. And as I mentioned, also the wood stove was a central part of cabin life. Students chopping wood, hauling wood. We had a chore day every week where students were involved in this kind of community process of supplying their own heat. This is the whole group, faculty and students for 2012. Put a couple arrows in there so you can see our own EMU students, Brandon there on the right, and Heidi Long, now Heidi Jablonski, over on the left. In addition to the actual Oregon Extension program, we lived in a small community on top of Green Springs Mountain. Our kids had the opportunity to go to the Pinehurst School. This is a really unique, tiny, tiny little public school on top of a mountain. It's been held together over the years through lots of community involvement and fundraising. About 26 students, K through 8th, go to this school. And they have an amazing grant to do environmental education and all sorts of unique stuff. They had Medieval Day where they had reenactors come up. This is my daughter Eliza at Medieval Day. For a physics lesson, some of the kids made a working trebuchet and launched these balls over the highway, like hundreds of feet. It was amazing. My kids got to go on field trips to the Oregon coast, whitewater rafting. Eliza spent a week on an island off the coast of California studying ecology. This is all at a public school, so pretty amazing experience. The principal of the school was a former Oregon Extension faculty member, Sam Alvord. Every year, he writes a Christmas play for the kids, taking into account their individual personalities and casting them. And his wife, Pat, writes the music for it all. It's amazing. So that's my kids involved in that. Beyond that, there are other aspects of the community. Students got involved, Oregon Extension students got involved in a fundraiser for Green Springs Mountain. As part of that, I was able to do a community conservation photo workshop. That's Brandon Waggy again, looking at him from underwater. And students also had the experience of going further afield in Oregon and also in California. So in between the segments of study, we would take trips. And mostly these were a chance to relax and to discover more of the West. We went to the Oregon coast. That included the amazing redwoods. Another trip was to San Francisco. And as part of that experience, we got to visit Cliff Bar headquarters. Now, this might seem completely random, but you should know a little history. The founder of Cliff Bar was an Oregon Extension alum. And when the faculty who started the program in 1975 finally decided it was time to retire and pass it on to a new generation, the property had accumulated a lot in value in southern Oregon. It's many, many acres. And Gary Erickson and Kit Erickson, who started Cliff Bar, were able to purchase the property through their Cliff Bar Foundation. And they hired Heidi and Tad as directors of the program. And so our students had an opportunity to visit the Cliff Bar headquarters when we were down in San Francisco. And that was a really interesting experience. Inside Cliff Bar headquarters, they have a climbing wall. They gave all the students a grab bag where they could stuff about 80 Cliff Bars in their bag and take it home. I put this image on the bottom left, all these bicycles. One day, Gary, for a present, I guess a bonus for the employees of Cliff Bar, bought everybody a red bike. And that's what they had when they walked into work one day. A part two of this project involved conservation media and documenting biodiversity in this very special area called the Cascade-Siskiyou National Monument. And again, I'll introduce it with a short video that I put together for EMU, actually while I was out on sabbatical. We had Chris Johns from National Geographic come and visit us last year, and he'll be our commencement speaker this year. So faculty in visual and communication arts asked me if I could put together something about what I was doing, since, of course, it's related to conservation and wildlife. Greetings from Southern Oregon. I'm out here on sabbatical with my wife, Anna Maria, who's a creative writer. We're documenting the ecology of the Cascade-Siskiyou National Monument, which was the first national monument created specifically to protect biodiversity. There's still plenty of land at risk. There's old growth forest adjacent to the monument on federal land, which is still in danger of being logged. So the monument's an unfinished project, and visual communication is a part of advocating for protection. This fall, when I return to EMU, I'm going to be teaching a class in conservation photography. I'm also planning a May-term version of the class in Southern Oregon. I'm really excited about this. This is my passion. We'll get students involved partnering with regional conservation organizations. We're excited about the connections that are possible with National Geographic, the Look 3 Festival of the Photo, and the International League of Conservation Photographers. In some sense, I think that conservation photography is about empathy. It's about getting the viewers up and close and personal with the natural world. Because you can make an image of a salamander from above that might work okay for identification, but you just can't relate. But to get down in your belly, to be looking at a salamander in the eye, and experiencing it as another creature on this earth, that's what gets me excited. That's the kind of connection that I want to create with people. Or going underwater and encountering a fish or a frog in its own environment, to be part of that world for a little while and to bring other people along on the journey, that to me is what conservation photography is about. Creating that sort of space where people can become connected to the life forms that surround them, whether they are in their backyard or halfway across the world. To be able to care, to be able to empathize, is the beginning of conservation. And that's the kind of connection that I really want our students to understand. And that type of visual communication involves a whole range of skills: macro photography, off-camera flash, underwater photography, telephoto work, camera traps, and it involves collaboration with scientists, nonprofits, and government agencies. It's important to understand not only the technical aspects, but the cultural and political implications of the type of work they are going to be doing. EMU is a great place to do this kind of work. The Shenandoah Valley is right on the edge of Appalachia, kind of nestled between the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Allegheny Mountains. We have endemic species, like the cowknob salamander, that need protected areas. There are water quality issues to address related to the Chesapeake watershed. The Black's Run is next door. The Shenandoah River is a 15-minute drive away. These creeks and rivers are in danger from overdevelopment, agricultural runoff, and we need to raise awareness about these impacts, and that's part of what we'll be doing in the class. And we have students who are already passionate about the environment and passionate about photography. That's a great place to start. So part of my application for the sabbatical was thinking about preparing for a class in conservation photography back here at EMU. So I was trying to use this as a kind of an exemplar. What is it like to work with nonprofit organizations where conservation issues are live? What kind of equipment do I need? I've been gearing up for this for a while, but this was a chance to really sink my teeth into a long-term project and think about how it might work and how it might transfer to students. So this is our tiny little cabin and some of my equipment laid out for an expedition. One of the key players in the preservation of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument is this fellow, Dave Willis, a wildlands advocate. He has pushed relentlessly to preserve the area and conserve the area around Lincoln, where the Oregon Extension exists. Now, the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument, a little bit more about it. One of the things a lot of people back east said when we talked about a monument, you imagine kind of the Washington Monument or these small areas. But this is part of the Antiquities Act. A monument in the West can also be a very large area of land that's set aside to protect some area of archaeological or historic or scientific interest. And the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument was the first monument set aside solely for the preservation of biodiversity. So our project was to document this biodiversity. Now, at first, when I made this proposal, I used the language of the Soda Mountain Wilderness and the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. As I actually got on the ground and we discovered what this place was about, we realized that the area that I had first talked about in my proposal, mentioning again the Soda Mountain Wilderness, was actually a subset of this larger area, and that the real story was about the protection of this large swath of land, with some areas inside of it that were set aside as special wilderness areas that received even more protection. As Anna Maria and I approached this project, we talked a lot about how we could collaborate. I'm a photographer and a visual artist. She's a writer and also a visual artist. And we decided that we would make a series of photo essays, that we would explore these first as part of a website, and then we would take some of these photo blog posts and we would start to adapt them to print. So every day we'd get up. Oftentimes I'd go out hiking, exploring, asking people what I could find in different parts of the monument. It's a very geographically diverse place. Anna Maria would often come along with her sketchbook, her notepad, and then we would come back together and talk about what we'd seen and see how we could combine these skills to create something new with these collaborative photo essays. Now you can go to the website, cascade-siskiyou.org, and see more of these. But I'll talk a little bit just about one in particular. This photo essay was called The Checkerboard Map of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. And the checkerboard refers to the mix of public and private land that you find in the monument. You'll notice that on the map, it actually looks like a checkerboard. There are some areas that are shaded, that are protected as part of this presidential proclamation 13 years ago. And there are other areas that are not included in the actual monument. Now, the Bureau of Land Management that's actually responsible for managing this land, over time, now that there's a large area that's protected, is trying to fill in the gaps. But I was interested in this map. It looks like a checkerboard. What does it look like from the sky? Can you see any of that? So while Anna Maria and I were pondering this, I went to Google Earth, and this is what I found. So Anna Maria wrote this great essay called The Abstract Made Actual. And it's about how our political decisions actually are written literally on the ground. And you can see it so clearly. Now, this will change over time. Some of those areas will fill in. It tends to be the private land that's very heavily grazed and very heavily logged. The government sold leases, too, to be logged, but they have stricter management. One of the things that was really exciting to me is that I was able to use some of my photography in conjunction with Dave Willis, this wildlands advocate, to do some real-life conservation advocacy. So one of the things that Dave is doing now is working on protecting land that's right on the boundaries of this protected area. And some of that land includes old-growth stands, but it's still possibly open for logging. And he's fighting that. He wants to see some of these areas be subsumed into the larger monument. And if they're logged, they'll no longer be considered to have wildland characteristics, and then it's kind of a lost cause. So it's a little bit of a race against time to get people to care about these areas before they're logged so that they can then receive special designation. So I was able to go on some of these survey trips with him and photograph people exploring these old-growth groves. Right behind the Oregon Extension Program, just about a mile up from our cabin, is this incredible view of Mount Shasta looking into California. And just to give you a sense of some of the biodiversity that's here just in the mile around Lincoln. Up here on this peak, I was poking through the woods and I heard this sort of grunt and ran into this guy, a Roosevelt elk. It's just an amazing experience to be out there alone in the snow on top of a mountain and, you know, then have this creature is probably 800 pounds staring back at you. Deer were a constant companion, right in Lincoln, jackrabbits, all sorts of bird life, pileated woodpeckers. This is a ruby-crowned kinglet. On Thanksgiving one day, we were walking just on the property and saw this giant bird swoop over us, and it landed in a branch. It turned out to be a great gray owl, the largest owl in North America. Other hikes took us further afield to places like Hobart Bluff, where there's an amazing overlook. You can see so much of the monument. And then I did specialized studies of particular types of animals. Lizards, some of you know my amphibian obsession. Dragonflies. Creatures that are unique to the West, like scorpions. I was interested in behaviors, too. I spent a long time in vernal pools when the spring came, watching Pacific chorus frog tadpoles develop, and sometimes there was predation, too, although I admit I actually saved this tadpole after I photographed it. I think frogs need all the help they can get these days. Simply being out in the world and observing, you start to notice things. I turned over a rock and found this Pacific chorus frog. About 5 minutes later, it looked like this on the right. They change colors. And sometimes they change colors to match their surroundings. Can you see it? There's a little arrow. This is amazing camouflage, and you can see exactly why it's striped the way it is. It's blending right into the bark and even picking up on some of the shadows in the ponderosa pine bark. I love salamanders. I was excited to see the diversity of salamanders, ones I hadn't seen before in the Pacific Northwest. Some species are in trouble, like the Oregon spotted frog. This is a creature that was thought to no longer exist in the monument until a class from Southern Oregon University came up and found it about 10 years ago. And now it's known as the westernmost population in Oregon. A very small population, still in a lot of danger. And of course, I wanted to find one. So I spent many, many days trudging through the early spring snow in waders, going out to a pond and looking for it until I finally one day found one. And that looks like this. It's March 20th. I'm right next to a Parsnips Lake at a marsh. And I just found an Oregon spotted frog in here. Really exciting. These guys are rare and they were only discovered up here just a few years back in the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. So, very exciting to see this. You can see there's still quite a bit of snow on the ground. It was a slog getting out here, but very much worth it. And there's the deer over here. Underwater camera was the primary thing that I used, although it was actually photography on land, but kept things dry. And a much more ubiquitous presence were the Pacific chorus frogs. When spring started, we would hear these giving out their mating calls every night. If you were in the gallery exhibition, you heard this going on a loop. And one other frog species. These are bullfrogs. And after studying these tiny, tiny Pacific chorus frogs, to one day walk next to the ditch in Lincoln and see a frog about this big was really startling. I saw two of them that had obviously been there for years, and I gave them names, T-Rex and Old Blind Darby. Bullfrogs were actually introduced to the West as a game species for frog legs. So that's why they're there. They're not native, but they have taken over a lot of land, and they just cause trouble for endangered species, like the state endangered Oregon spotted frog. Another one of my goals while I was out west was to develop a new technique that I called iPad hybrid drawings. And with these, I would create a base photograph and then bring it into my iPad and then start drawing over it, and then I would get rid of the original photograph or make it very light and continue to work over it as a kind of virtual drawing. So that was a really fun process to get back into drawing. My background in college days was a studio art major, so I've always loved to draw, and it was really gratifying to be able to do this in a field context. So I experimented with a number of different processes, from simulating woodcuts to working with oil and watercolor paint. And meanwhile, Anna Maria was out with a sketchbook too, doing drawings, and those appeared in our exhibition. Beyond Lincoln and the Cascade Siskiyou Monument, we did spend some time further afield. One of the OE faculty members, John Linton, who's been there long term, is a birder, an amateur, but very accomplished in his identification. So he took us out several times to the Klamath Basin National Wildlife Refuge. An amazing place where you can literally see thousands of birds at any given time. And saying that, this place is a fraction of what it used to be. It used to be millions of birds would take off and darken the sky. A lot of the water has been drained for agricultural purposes, but still an amazingly impressive place. We spent time at the Redwoods, which, if you do one thing out west, get to the Redwoods. Just the sheer stature of them blew me away. And we also spent some time at a place called the Opal Creek Wilderness. Anna Maria, both of us became friends with a man named John Villela, who is a lichenologist. And when I say that to people, he's like, oh, what? He's actually a senior lichenologist. One of the things that happened in the West in the Clinton era was something called the Northwest Forest Plan. And this was a plan to think about logging, management, and biodiversity in the West. And out of that process, there was a need to catalog diversity and catalog endangered species. So that opened up opportunities for lots of biologists to get into this survey field. And John's specialty was in surveying lichen. Well, it happened after we got to know each other around the context of the monument that we found out he was going to be teaching a workshop on lichens, mosses, and liverworts in this place called the Opal Creek Wilderness. And this was an opportunity for us to see a really different side of Oregon. The monument is a little bit dry. It's right on the dividing line between the wet side and the dry side of Oregon. But up a little bit further, closer to Portland, was this area. And you can see why it's called Opal Creek, although I think it was actually named after a person. As I was driving into this wilderness area, on the right, I saw this scene about 10 miles outside of the wilderness. And I actually used this as our exhibition poster here at EMU because I think it gives such a stark contrast between a preserved area and one that's open for clear cutting. And the type of lichens and mosses that grow over here on the left take literally hundreds of years to develop that level of thickness and richness. So Anna Maria had a chance to take this workshop. She ended up co-authoring an article with John about the nature of lichens, and I spent a long time just doing field work in that area. Eventually, I got to go back. I actually contributed some photography to their brochure. They do a number of workshops in this area. And lots more salamanders. Really excited to find this one. The one you see up here, large, is called a Pacific giant salamander. And most of the time, you see them like this in an aquatic stage. But every so often, they go terrestrial. And they become a fully terrestrial salamander. But they're very rare to find. In fact, staff that we talked to at Opal Creek, some of them have never seen one. Or maybe they'd seen one in their life. I went out with my friend Dave. We found two in one weekend. So it was pretty thrilling. Anna Maria also went out with John, and he was doing some surveys of a rare flower called the Gentner's fritillary, endangered species. So she got to be really involved in some actual survey work. And that brought us to the end of the semester. We took a different route home through the Southwest, stopped in the Grand Canyon, loaded up our crazy dog again, took Route 66 for a while, and finally arrived back home in Virginia. Some specific outcomes from the semester. As I mentioned, I got to do some actual advocacy work with my photography. I worked with Backyard Forest. They were doing a section on some of the areas outside of the monument that were not yet preserved, but were owned by the BLM. So that was really exciting. I got to prep for the conservation photo class at EMU. That's our group from last semester. Had a really good time with them. And they got involved partnering with organizations around here. Some of them were local wilderness organizations. Colt Duttweiler did some work with Jim Yoder's conservation class in biology. The image that you see on the top right is a white box image done in something called Meet Your Neighbors style. Han Park, one of our students, who's graduating very soon, got involved with this technique, really took it to the next level. And some folks who are involved in National Geographic and run this international website called Meet Your Neighbors were really interested that a student was picking this up. Han wrote a blog post for them, which is featured on their website. So that was exciting. While I was out there, I was continuing to do some work for a publishing house. The National Association of Science Teachers does a book series. I published one with them, a collaborative process with several photographers called Next Time You See a Firefly. While I was out in Oregon, I got to do another one called Next Time You See a Pill Book. I mentioned that Anna Maria did a collaborative article in a peer-reviewed journal called PAN. I got to do the illustrations for that. So that was a really fun way to continue that collaborative process. Our website is an ongoing project, and we'll continue to add to it as we unpack the many, many thousands of images from our semester. A fun little thing. One of our authors at the Oregon Extension is Brian Doyle, who's, I think, at the University of Oregon. He wrote a book called Mink River, which was part of our reading list, and he also publishes in Orion, which is a magazine that I work with often. For this issue, he wrote an essay called 20 Things the Dog Ate. And I thought, my dog eats things, lots of things. So we, the kids and I and Anna Maria, rounded up everything our dog had chewed on and brought it out in the yard. And then I thought, oh, if she was actually there, she might do something. So Anna Maria brought her out. As soon as she saw the troll baby in the middle, she started chewing on it. That kind of made the image. I worked on some marketing for the Oregon Extension, new video, revising the website. And we're working on a book project based on the images, the photo essays. So we're getting that into a print-ready format. Another collaboration was working with an outfit called Hot House, which is part of a journal called Newfound. And it's about ecology and place. So Anna Maria was blogging for them. I was doing some illustration for them during the course of the semester. And then finally, most recently, was the exhibit at EMU of this work. And that was really gratifying to be able to bring all the work into one place. And that was accompanied by Anna Maria's essays. So again, an interesting way to bring everything together in print. I think that brings us to the end. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions.
What part of your semester out there was it raining? Is it
Yeah, we get some rain in the spring. It was pretty dry for most of the year. It is that dividing line. So there's a rainy season, but it doesn't last that long. The fall semester, when the students are out there, there's hardly any rain at all. They do get some snow around Thanksgiving and into December. And then we got quite a bit of snow. That was fun. We could go cross-country skiing and snowshoeing.
So, Steve, this was so beautiful. Thank you. From this, that rhythm that you established in Oregon, how are you and what are you bringing back here from that experience? In what ways are you seeing that infused into reentry?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things in particular was trying to work with the conservation photography class. And honestly, that's really challenging. Because the type of work that that class demands involves being out in the field for many, many hours at a time. And a typical college schedule makes that difficult. So we tried to work around that by scheduling the class in a double block on a Thursday so that we had 3.5 hours to work. But still, you drive out to a place that's half an hour away, drive home again, and you've got a couple hours out in the field. You want to go further afield, you know, you might only be out for an hour. And that's challenging for students, their work schedules, all the other things that they're committed to. So I keep thinking about this. Are there ways to open up space to do things like that? I mean, in some ways, I think the OE is similar in concept to what students tell us about our cross-cultural semesters, where they get to do one thing at a time, and what a valuable learning experience that is. And for many years, I've wondered, is there a way to open up more of that in a typical campus experience? So that's something that's on my mind. I'm also trying to integrate this type of field work into my life. I've been networking with a lot of conservation photographers. And sometimes people ask me, what does that actually mean, conservation photography, as opposed to nature photography? And it's really about advocacy. It's moving beyond just, what do I find interesting aesthetically, and thinking about the entire ecosystem and what matters, what do we need to protect, kind of understanding what's disturbed, what's not, the broader context of the issues.
Thanks, Steve. I would argue that we all have a lot to argue for in our Shenandoah Mountain. To the west, there's, as many of us know, a move to frack that mountain and destroy a lot of pristine real estate. My understanding is that that's the largest contiguous roadless area east of the Mississippi.
Now, some of my students were actually involved.
Excellent.
With folks.
Excellent. So keep us, keep our feet to the fire is my charge to you.
Thanks. Yeah, actually, a couple of the salamanders that you saw were from Shenandoah Mountain. There's some really unique endemic species up there.
Steve, I was wondering about that checkerboard area with the monument and all the private landowners and the mix there. What are there tensions out there? What is the attitude towards the monument? This is a recent monument.
Yeah.
And does that affect your work or the work of OE out there?
Yeah, there certainly were tensions going into the process of creating the monument. You know, lots of community meetings. Certainly there was some resistance. Dave Willis was, I think, really good at anticipating where a lot of that resistance would come from and helping people to think about ways in which it might be beneficial. For example, hunting's still open. So that was a big relief to people. And I think a lot of people thought, no, it won't really be open once the monument's there. But it is. In fact, when I set up camera traps, the first thing I found were hunters walking by. So that puts, you know, some of their minds at ease. However, there's another effort to create a monument just south of the border in California. That's meeting with all sorts of resistance. It's a very, very conservative area of California that's very concerned about the government taking over land or doing something different with it that might affect traditional rights on the land. So yeah, there's a lot of tension right now over ideas of expanding the monument or creating new monuments that are nearby.
Dumb question. Legally, what's the difference between a national monument and a national park?
It's a difference in purpose. Actually, one of the folks we met at the Bureau of Land Management had come out of the Park Service and now was working for the monument. And he said the biggest thing that he noticed was at the Park Service, they were trying to get people to come and to recreate. And here in the monument, it was a very different purpose. They were actually decommissioning roads. And it really, the purpose was for preservation and biodiversity. So there's an educational and interpretive outreach mission, but they're not trying to bring in hordes of people. There's never going to be hotels or food stations set up. That's not their mission.
Anything else? If not,
thank you.